Thank you. There's no question, the point you'll make is that, and this was affirmed by Chief Justice John Marshall in the early days of the Republic, that your sovereignty is not a granted sovereignty, it's a retained sovereignty. When we recognize France, when we recognize Germany or Japan, we don't give them sovereignty, we recognize their sovereignty. And John Marshall made it very clear in his decision, as you point out, that this is a retained sovereignty. It's not something given to you. It's something that you had before the first Europeans landed here. And so this committee, I think, without probably any dissent, would recognize, but I think it's very important that we keep reiterating that it is a retained sovereignty upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. Thank you very much. Now we'll hear from John Daniels, the Vice Chair of the Muckleshoot Tribal Council, Auburn, Washington.
Good morning. I'm still on the other Washington time. I'm sorry. Mr. Chairman.
You come from the real Washington, right?
John Daniels, Jr., Teedstat, Muckleshoot, Obstchud. I'm Muckleshoot Indian. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe. And I am pleased to have the opportunity to appear today on behalf of the Muckleshoot Indian Tribe, the Puyallup Tribe of Indians, and the Tulalip Tribes, three federally recognized Indian tribes. The Muckleshoot Reservation near Seattle is one of the reservations on which the United States encouraged Duwamish Indians to locate in the years following negotiation of the 1855 Treaty of Point Elliott. Many members of the Muckleshoot Tribe are descendants of Duwamish who settled on the Muckleshoot Reservation. In the years following the treaty, Duwamish also located on the Puyallup and Tulalip reservations, and their descendants are today members of the Puyallup and Tulalip tribes. The Muckleshoot, Puyallup, and Tulalip tribes oppose H.R. 2678. The Duwamish group has already had its claim to tribal status fully considered by both the courts and the executive branch. They each concluded that the Duwamish claim to tribal status is without merit. Both found the Duwamish group does not possess the essential characteristics that distinguish a tribal political entity from other minority groups. Maintenance from historic times to the present of a functioning community and the exercise of political authority in that community. In 1979, in United States versus Washington, District Judge George Bull, after hearing evidence submitted by the Duwamish group, found that the group was not a tribe and was not a successor to the historic Duwamish tribe that signed the Point Elliott Treaty. He concluded that the Duwamish do not have not lived as a continuous, separate, distinct, and cohesive Indian cultural or political entity, and have not maintained an organizational tribal structure in a political sense. The Court of Appeals for the Ninth District Court, after carefully re-examining the record, affirmed Judge Bull's determination, and the Supreme Court denied review. In 1996, during the Clinton administration, the Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs issued a proposed finding against acknowledgement of the Duwamish group as an Indian tribe. In 2001, the Department of the Interior affirmed the proposed finding and issued a final determination against acknowledgement. The detailed decisions rejecting the Duwamish group's claim to tribal status was supported by 300 pages of exhaustive technical reports. In May 2008, the Duwamish filed a lawsuit in the United States District Court for the Western District of Washington, challenging the Department of the Interior's determination. One of the claims that Duwamish takes in the lawsuit is that the Duwamish group was administratively recognized on the last days of the Clinton administration. That claim was the subject of a Department of the Interior Inspector General's report. The Inspector General found that after leaving office, the acting Assistant Secretary involved in the matter signed an unfinished draft decision without authority, in which he reached a conclusion contrary to the Bureau of Indian Affairs' strong recommendations against acknowledgement. The Muckleshoot, Puyallup, and Tulalip tribes are confident the court will reject this claim along with others raised by the Duwamish. As noted, both the courts and the executive branch have independently concluded that the Duwamish group has not retained minimal elements of historic community structure and political authority that distinguish an Indian tribe from other minorities. The Department of the Interior found that many important Duwamish families moved to Muckleshoot and other reservations where they and their descendants became part of the reservation-based tribal communities, and that the Duwamish group seeking recognition is a fraction of Duwamish descendants whose ancestors remained off-reservation where they had little contact with one another and assimilated into the larger society. Recognition of a tribe is more than acknowledgement of ethnic identity. It is recognition that a group possesses and retains sovereign political authority predating the United States and possesses the governmental authority to regulate the conduct of its members and control activities of both Indians and non-Indians within its territory. Recognition of groups that have failed to maintain a real community, one that exercises some measure of political control over its membership, devalues and undermines the status of all Indian tribes as sovereign political entities with significant governmental authority. The Duwamish group's claims have been reviewed twice now and out with the same outcome. The issues that are presented are factually complex, and both the courts and executive branch engaged in a lengthy review of the historical record on the issue. In this context, we ask that the committee defer to the courts and the executive branch. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We'll now begin with some questions, and I'll start myself and then defer. Chairwoman Hansen, can you explain some of the ways that the Duwamish has maintained some political influence over their members throughout the 1900s until the present?
Well, I will tell you that our chief was the recognized leader of the Duwamish tribe. And then up until the 20s, when we decided to reorganize, we adopted a constitution in 1925. Peter James was the chairman then. We've had six leaderships since 1925. That's what we govern ourselves. I'm the second woman to serve for the Duwamish Tribal Council. So from 1925 up to 2009, we've had six leaders. These honorable men who work with all the other tribes in the Pacific Northwest, supporting other tribes in the South. So I think that we've had a continuous leadership of our tribe.
Thank you. Mr. Inslee.
Thank you. Before I ask questions, I want to invite and hope that I can see you all at the end of the great canoe journey, which will end at the Suquamish Nation in the first week of August. It happens to be in the first congressional district. I hope that you could attend. First off, let me ask about the communications that have gone on between the various tribes in the Puget Sound region. This is a very difficult issue, frankly, of those of us who have so many friends on various sides of this issue. And it's particularly sort of heartrending, frankly, because we have, you know, Chief Seattle herself, whose father was Suquamish and mothers are Duwamish. Do I have that right?
Yes. I think
that's correct.
Yes.
And yet we have a letter from the Suquamish saying they do not agree to this at the moment, and they made reference to a lack of communication, at least officially, between the Duwamish people and the Suquamish people. And I just wonder if you could tell us what communications have gone on or not gone on, trying to see what would be the ramifications of fishing rights, of, you know, health care rights vis-a-vis other tribes. Have there been communications? What have those been, and if not, what's the situation?
May I answer that?
Yes, I'll pose that to Chair Daniels and Chair Sharp and yourself.
Okay. The communication between the Suquamish and the Duwamish, I think, has been ongoing. I have been friends with former chairs. Georgia George was chairman one time, and we used to go to NCI, and so we meet each other. And Emerson George was chair. I have been talking back and forth. And one thing that I am part Suquamish too. My grandmother, my mother's mother, is buried next to the chief. When I go to Suquamish, I am at home. Mm-hmm. And when we got into the negative determination, then I start trying to talk to the current chairman now. He finally relented to express his opinion. He was concerned about if we ever got acknowledged, there would be some concern about benefits. And I told Leonard, floorsman. I said, don't worry about it, Leonard. I said, once we get recognized, we're going to be dealing with the Bureau about benefits. And I don't know why they're concerned about fish, because we know that we were told by former consul that if we ever got acknowledged and really disappointed, this is 10, 15 years ago, we'd have to go to court to open that case to get the right to fish. So I was disappointed, because the reason we got into the process, because we lost that right in Judge Bolt. So we just, our consul came together and we said, okay, we'll just go get acknowledged and we'll get our fishing rights. Well, that didn't happen. But, you know, we're not disappointed. It's just the way things, and then the process has taken like forever. But I think that I'm talking about communication between tribes. I'll tell you, in 1989, we tried to meet with the Muckleshoot to see what their problem was, and nobody would meet with us. And I was sad, and one of our former consuls went up to there, and we just wanted to sit down as Indian people and to talk. I think that as I go around speaking, there has to be a healing in Indian country where we're not fighting each other. It has to stop. We as human beings that are walking on this earth just be supportive. There's too much war going on, so to speak. And we would sit down with anybody and talk to them. We are at peace with everybody else, and we don't understand why we're taken to task, because we want to be acknowledged, because we do have the right. And for Squamish to bring that issue up about fishing, I don't quite understand. And at no time did Leonard ever bring that up about fishing or fish.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I want to make sure other chairs have a chance to respond to that. Chairman Daniels?
Yeah, I was chair of Muckleshoot for about 10 years, and we received letters asking to meet. I bring them to the tribal council, and they told me that when, you know, they got through the process and were recognized, we'd, you know, sit down and talk. But with the same with Snoqualmie, after they were recognized, we had a couple of meetings to talk about their gaming. And, you know, we told them about us purchasing Salish Lodge, which is close to their land up there. But it was a tribal council decision. So,
thank you.
Thank you. You know, when the 1988 and the 89 recognition petitions came forward, I was just coming out of high school, so I wasn't at that point deeply entrenched or have a working knowledge of the history. And once this legislation was introduced and once we found this was coming forward, I did talk to both the council and our staff about the need to come to this preliminary hearing and at the same time open up communications and as this moves through Congress, I have dialogue about our respective interests, and so it's our intention to continue that discussion. And as I mentioned earlier in my remarks, that I appreciate what you're saying, Congressman Inslee, about which side are you on. There's so many different conflicting things, and I can only think of a quote that during the Civil War, President Abraham Lincoln invited clergy to the Oval Office, about ready to make some decisions. And as he walked out, the clergyman said, "Boy, I sure hope the Lord's on our side." And President Lincoln looked at him and said, "You know, it's my constant daily prayer that we're on the side of the Lord." And so I think it's important to really understand that if we look at the rightness, the justice of it all, there are process, there are procedures. If we respect the administrative process, if we respect the political process and the legal process, each one of those have a path of integrity. And if we all respect that and follow it, I believe that we can get to a true and correct end, and that is the path that we need to take.
Thank you. The chair, allow me another question or two, Mr. Chair. Would you allow me another couple of questions here? Thank you very much. Could you describe to us in the Bolt decision, Chair Sharp made reference to Judge Bolt not accepting the Duwamish as having a treaty right to fishing, as I understand it. Should we fairly characterize that as a full adjudication of the Duwamish as to whether or not they are a recognized tribe or not, or was that a peripheral decision to the adjudication? Chair Williams, would you like to address that issue first?
About the judge vote?
Yes. I mean, was that I mean, was there a full adjudication about the history of the Duwamish to determine whether or not they were should be recognized at that time, or was that just a peripheral thing that Judge Bolt put in his decision without hearing testimony on it?
I believe it was for fishing rights. But I know that since that decision, they turn it around and say, and they keep saying, I hear this all the time, that, oh, you lost your fishing rights, therefore you're not a federally recognized tribe. So they reverse what the whole intent of that case was.
But did Judge Bolt do a review of the anthropological evidence and the political, whether or not, you know, did he inquire as to all these issues we now are looking, the political continuity, the geographic usage? Was that part of his review?
I think it was, but I must tell you that our former chair, Willard Bill, was asked, request by Judge Bolt to get some material in, and because he had got sick, that sort of, he didn't get it in. And Willard Bill was our former chair. He has now passed on, but he became a Muckleshoot member. And the court has said that, you know, the treaty is not a recognition determination, and it's not. And I feel bad for what happened when we were in court because of our chairman. I wasn't involved at the time, but got involved with Mr. Willard Bill at the time I was working with him, and he forgot, or didn't forget, he was sick, he didn't get the material, and I think that kind of hurt us too, at least for the Duwamish people.
Yes. Chair Daniels or Sharp, would you like to comment on that?
We included Judge Bull's decision. There was a full adjudication. It's within our written testimony.
Yeah, I guess the question is, for those who were not there then, I mean, was there a full, you know, calling of witnesses about the history of the Duwamish, or at least an opportunity to do that in that litigation? Do you know?
There was a trial, I know. Yeah.
That's something I would be interested in any event. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Inslee. Mr. Baird.
Thank the chairman. I thank our witnesses. I want to direct my question to Ms. Sharp. Two people down from you is Ray Gardner. Would you suggest Mr. Gardner does or does not exist?
I absolutely would agree. I could see him physically. He is here. He's an individual. I'm sure he has a mother. I'm sure he has a father. I'm sure he was given birth. He's here. I would agree.
That's good to hear. We're on a good start. Would you suggest that, would you dispute that his ancestry has lived at the mouth of the Columbia for an extended period of time?
I am not knowing his personal family history. I couldn't speak to that issue directly.
Okay. Well, I believe they have. Are you aware that he was elected in a tribal election according to their constitution within the last month?
I'm not absolutely aware, but I've seen evidence of his leadership. I've seen him at the Centennial Accord meetings with the governor. I've had discussions with him about climate change. So I presume that he is there with the lawful election and authority of the Chinook people.
That's my understanding as well. And there are three other extant members of the Chinook leadership here with us as well. If it had gone a different way historically and the federal government had said to the Quinault people, look, we're going to establish a reservation at the mouth of the Columbia, and we're going to take the land in the Olympic Peninsula area and elsewhere where your folks are. We're going to give you a choice of either going over and living on the Spokane Reservation or going down to the mouth of the river. What do you think your folks would have done?
I believe the Quinault people stayed along the shoreline, the river. It's plentiful. We have a spiritual, a cultural, and a historic connection with the geographical area, which we've lived from time immemorial.
Are you mentioned at any point in the journals of Lewis and Clark?
Am I mentioned?
No, not you personally, the Quinault people.
I don't know specifically if we are mentioned. I've never read the journals.
What written basis do you have? What written historical basis do you have or anthropological evidence that your people inhabited the Columbia River, lower Columbia River?
We do have extensive anthropological scientific research. During the Bolt hearings, there was an adjudication, and we did bring evidence forward, not only in that case, but other federal decisions.
Would you believe you were the dominant tribe in the mouth of the Columbia River historically?
I don't believe we are the dominant. I believed.
You believe the dominant tribe was historically.
I have no idea who the dominant
tribe.
I have no idea who may have been the dominant. From what I understand, tribes both in Oregon and Washington shared in that resource. I've not read, nor do I have the scientific background to state affirmatively who might have been the dominant. I could surmise. I could make political policy opinions on that, but I don't.
You are here.
Yes.
Ms. Sharp. On the one hand, you're suggesting to us that you lack knowledge. On the other hand, you're providing the committee with testimony suggesting you're qualified to offer extensive opinion. It's a rather selective lack of knowledge, it would seem.
I would challenge that by suggesting it's not the merits of this in the substance of whether or not those bases are there. I'm challenging the political integrity of the process whereby there is a separation of powers. There was a determination by the Department of Interior that were scientists that did have the scientific knowledge, that persons that are in political positions both in Congress and in the agency challenged that decision and did not give professional deference to those. So that is the issue. It's not so much whether or not on the merits, whether the evidence is there. I'm not to judge that. I'm a politician. I'm an elected official. We leave that to the experts, and that's what Quinault is pressing.
Okay, but your testimony, just for the record, the testimony, Mr. Chairman, is replete with historical observations, and it is under the authorship of Ms. Sharp, who now is suggesting to us that she lacks the historical knowledge to opine about, or perhaps evidence to opine about presence of tribes at the mouth. Let me shift to a different historical question. Is it correct or not that the Quinault people engage in crab fishing past the breakers right now?
Yes, we do.
Do you have any historical, anthropological, archaeological evidence that was a traditional source or location of crab fishing prior to the modern era?
We have not expended resources to make that determination. It's our belief through oral history with elders that we did, in fact, do that. We also have enlisted experts that did testify in the United States versus Washington litigation that did come forward that possess that type of anthropological scientific evidence. We have not expended the resources to compile that to state definitively as a matter of political policy that is the case, but we believe that the evidence is there.
That's rather remarkable, Mr. Chairman, I will just tell you. No doubt the Northwest tribes were great canoeists. In fact, Lewis and Clark refers to Chinook canoeists as being some of the finest sea people he's ever seen in a canoe. So there's no question that I will grant the prowess. However, the notion that indigenous fisheries were able to go miles out offshore, drop lines several hundred feet down and bring up heavy crab pots is a bit of a stretch. And the reason I say that is because there are many crab fishermen back home who feel, quite frankly, that the Quinault and others, but predominantly Quinault, have substantially overreached in the crab fishery. And it's been something that's come to my attention for many, many years, and we've frankly not pursued it vigorously. But I think there may be merit to asking whether or not the Quinault or others have a traditional right or even a current right to fish well past the breakers, because I find the historical evidence of question. And I just want to have that for the record. Now, back to the current issue.
I'd like to respond to that, if I may.
Sure.
My response to that would be we adjudicated our rights to both fish, crab, a number of fishery resources. And as part of the litigation, the door was open for the Quinaults to negotiate on an annual basis our catch, our fishery. With regard to the crab fishery, we have a quota. Quinault Nation has never come even close to reaching that quota. And that is reserved by treaty. It is a right that's reserved from time immemorial. It was not given us to by Congress. It was not given us to by the courts. It's secured by treaty, and it was proven and established through over 10 years of litigation.
There are differences of opinion on that, Mr. Chair, I'll say for the record. The question I would make here is that we've got a fairly difficult decision. I believe that the evidence is incontrovertible that the Chinook people have maintained continuous existence, continuous governance, that their historical record in their traditional tribal areas is certainly vastly stronger in the historical record than is the Quinault people's record to that area. maybe I've missed it, but you can now do a search online for the online journals of Lewis and Clark, and if there's a place where I missed it, where they talk about Quinault people at the mouth of the river, certainly upriver, I'd be interested in that. Maybe I've missed it, and it's plausible I have. There's no question at all that they talk about the Chinook. They talk about the Chinook from way, way upriver. And certainly that is the earliest. You can go with Gray as well. Gray's people traded with the Chinook at the mouth of the river. I don't think they talked about Quinault people there. Maybe I missed that as well. So the historical record is the Chinook were there. The evidentiary, the folks who live there will tell you Chinook people have been here forever. The folks who live down at the mouth of the river, they say, yeah, I knew so-and-so. I knew his grandfather knew my grandfather. They fished together, they hunted together, etc. So to now say, to imply that they don't deserve recognition just as much as the Quinault do, I find rather extraordinary. And I understand that you may have an interest in managing allotted lands, but I think if the allotted lands were allotted on behalf of the Chinook people, they have an interest in that as well. And I think they should have a right to self-governance. I think they should have a right to economic opportunity and all the other benefits that tribes enjoy. They've been actually, I think, remarkably willing to recognize that hunting and fishing rights, unlike the Quinault right now, Chinook have been remarkably willing to say, look, we're not going to ask for any special hunting or fishing rights other than ceremonial. They're not asking to go out past the breakers and crab fish other than like anybody else can crab fish today. So I'm disappointed, to be perfectly honest. I'm disappointed that a tribe which already enjoys so much. The Quinault Nation is one of the more prosperous tribes within Washington State. You wield quite a bit of political influence. You have a very beautiful area in which you live. You have economic opportunity. Some of your fishermen do quite well in the crab fisheries. And I'm quite disappointed, to be perfectly honest, that a nation that has been so successful would intervene in a fashion to try to prevent their neighbors from enjoying somewhat comparable autonomy, independence, respect, recognition, etc. I'm disappointed in that. And I would note for the record that that is not universal in the tribes. Grand Ronde has fully supported this issue, as has the most proximal tribe, the Shoalwater. So for the record, I have concerns about certain activities of the Quinault. I have concerns about this opposition. And I think it certainly is non-substantive by nature and certainly should not in any way, shape, or form impede the restoration, long-deserved restoration of the Chinook people. And I'm grateful again for the committee's opportunity to address this.
Can I respond to that?
You can respond to Mr. Baird, but we have to move
sure.
on.
Okay, I'd love to respond to both points that were made.
If you can briefly respond.
Okay, I will briefly respond. Congressman Baird, you stepped out of the room during my, you weren't here during my oral remarks. I talked about the fact that treaty-based rights have been adjudicated. They are reserved rights. It's something that Congress, the courts, did not give to the Quinault people. It's something that we exercise from time immemorial. That is the context in which those rights are established. Now, if Congress seeks to give rights that are outside of those that are reserved to the Quinault people, and you as a congressman have an abiding duty, a sworn duty, to uphold treaties, to uphold the Constitution. Now, within the parameters of those rights that are contained in the Quinault Treaty, you have a sworn duty to ensure that those rights are exercised without external interference by anyone. And so if you want to seek to give rights to the Chinook people that are outside of Quinault, that's congressional plenary authority and prerogative. So if that's the direction, and again, going back to the point made earlier, there should be some objective criteria basis. There are many tribal communities throughout the United States, and if Congress seeks to go down the road of granting extraneous rights that are not reserved by treaty, then that has to be a very deliberate decision. That has to be a decision made in the context of looking at those that are reserved and how to balance those to ensure that there is not a breach of trust for the obligations that the United States has to the Quinault people. We don't object to the nobility of Congress and wanting to go down that road to try to find equity, but it's a very complex situation. And our principle is in urging this Congress to protect and preserve and uphold the treaty and Constitution that you are sworn to do. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your questions and your response to Mr. Baird. I'd like to address a question to Chairman Chambers of the Burtlake Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians. You mentioned that the IRA failed to address the situation of the Burtlake tribe as you had no communal land. However, was your tribe's relationship with the federal government ever terminated by Congress?
Absolutely not.
And the fact that they may argue that you had no communal land, the argument would be based upon the fact that your village was burned down. I mean, you were driven off the land, were you not?
That's exactly right, Congressman. Although the original cemetery that is still there,
right,
we still tend that. That is still our land.
Yeah, in my mind, you kept some connection through the cemetery, and the rest of the land was destroyed deliberately to get you off the land so they could cut down the very valuable timber. See, my dad was born in 1883. He was 17 years old when the Burtlake village was burned down. My dad remembers that. That's the main reason that I got involved in Indian affairs. My dad always taught his children, his five children, that the Indians had been treated unjustly. And he always told the story of the destruction of the Burtlake village and community. When I got to the state legislature in 1965, one of the first bills I introduced, I read the Treaty of Detroit. And I suggest people read the treaties, they're very interesting. And I saw that in exchange for the land, which the Indians reluctantly gave, but more so was taken from them, in exchange for the land, they were promised at least two things, which I fought for. We're 44 years now. One was fishing rights in perpetuity, and I fought that. We won it in court, some little, maybe tweaks here and there, but basically the judge said perpetuity means perpetuity. And also they promised education to the Indians. And coupling that with the destruction of your community and other atrocities committed against other Indian tribes in Michigan, I introduced a bill, I and Jackie Vaughn introduced a bill which is still law in Michigan, it's been law about 40-some years, saying that any Michigan Indian can attend a public college and the state pays the tuition. And it was trying to somehow carry out the treaty. And as long as I have breath to breathe, I'm going to make sure that we do everything we can to bring justice to the Indians. Now, at times that requires a great deal of wisdom, because sometimes there are conflicts between the various Indian tribes. And Congress has to kind of weigh those conflicts and try to come to a just decision. And that's a difficult part. It's very easy for me when I can say, let's recognize this tribe, there's no conflict, no other tribe claiming. But when there are conflicting claims, then we need wisdom very much. And we hope we will use that wisdom. And you come to us expecting us to use that wisdom. And right now I can't decide, which way to go on this, but we will look at it. Some are very simple. I mean, the Burt Lake thing is just absolutely an example of the European settlers coming in, destroying a community. They destroyed it for two reasons, the village, so they wouldn't come back. They have no place to come back to, right? But they stayed around. They stayed around that church and just would not go away. And I'm committed to bring justice to Indians. I wish it was always simple. And today it's not as simple as it is sometimes. I've helped five tribes get their sovereignty recognized, not given to them. It's a retained sovereignty. That's a very important. And John Marshall uses that word, retained, in his decision. And John Marshall, as I said before, also said that a treaty made with the Indians has the same validity as a treaty made with a foreign nation, with France, that they are the law of the land, which the Constitution says. This Constitution and all treaties entered into are the supreme law of the land. The laws of the various states to the contrary notwithstanding. So the Constitution does recognize that. I wish that we had a magic wand and could wave it over and just make sure everyone got justice, but we have a little conflict today, but we're going to try to resolve that to the best of our ability. And unless there's further questions, we have probably a vote coming up soon. But I deeply appreciate your leadership. You run for office just like I ran for office. You were chosen by your citizens. And by the way, in my own way, I never refer to members of a tribe. As members imply that you belong to the Knights of Columbus or the Elks Club. That's okay. I mean, you can call yourself what you want under your sovereignty, right? But I always say citizens. How many citizens do you have? And I think citizen does flow better from sovereignty than, that's my own view, than members.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I may?
Yes, sir.
I so appreciate the eloquence of your words. It occurs to me that in my questioning of Ms. Sharp and our interchange, I did not invite Mr. Gardner to offer his comments. And I think for the record, if you could indulge maybe four or five more minutes for him to respond if he needs to, I think that'd be warranted. I'd much be grateful for that.
Okay, about 5 minutes,
that'd be great. Thank
certainly,
you.
Mr. Baird.
Well, I would just like to again thank everyone for the honor of being here and being able to speak on behalf of our people. And I would just like to emphasize that from time immemorial, we have been on the Lower Columbia River and on the Willapaw River. I think we have very good relations with our neighboring tribes that come up against our land. And I would like to say even here that for other tribes within the state that we could or possibly have issues with, I would be more than happy to sit down and work with them and find a compromise and a middle ground that would benefit all of the people involved. It is something that, for me, is very important to get our people restored. In the last year, which the last one just being last Sunday, just prior to coming back here, I went to a celebration of life for another one of our elders that crossed to the other side. I have been at the services for the last of our traditional basket makers that was involved in this struggle for over 60 years, that I'm just continuing her work. And I had to go and speak on her family's behalf when she passed. Her husband, one of our last traditional canoe carvers, is now in the final stages of dementia and suffering from terminal cancer. One of the things that I would like to add on a personal note is my mother, who is a very important piece of my life, And about a year ago, we were coming back from a tribal meeting, and she relayed a story to me that I had not heard before. And the story was that as my grandmother, who was dying of cancer, sat her down, and what she wanted to tell her was to continue this fight, to get justice, to get our people restored. My grandmother knew that in her final stages she would not be around to see that, and relayed that to my mother. And she said that in her lifetime she knew that she would not make it to see the restoration of our people, but that my mother would in her lifetime. My mother is now going to be 76 next month. Her health is not what it was. She's been legally blind for 8 years. And the reason she wanted to tell me that story was because she also relayed that to me, that she was afraid that in her lifetime she would not see this come to fruition, but that I would in mine. And I think on behalf of all of our people, all of our citizens, and I have to say I like that better than members myself. It does flow much better. But this is very important. We've watched too many of our people have crossed to the other side while fighting this struggle for justice. I want to really commend Congressman Baird and all of his staff for all of the hard work they have put into. I've worked personally with the congressman and his staff now for going on 6 years, and they have put in a lot of time and a lot of effort, and all of our members greatly appreciate that. And I'm very hopeful and looking forward to the day that we do get our people restored. And I know I'm in communication with many tribes up and down the Columbia River, in eastern Washington, in Idaho, in Oregon, which our people did live on both sides of the river. The Columbia was not a deterrent at that point. It was just a way of transporting our people in our canoes from one side to the other. And we were there before there was a Washington and an Oregon. But all of those tribes have shown a great interest in being there to help us on the day that we celebrate getting our place restored in history. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner, for your remarks. Mr. Sinclair, do you have any closing remarks or thoughts you would like to leave with the committee?
Well, no, not really. I can only ask again that you would consider marking this bill up. I know that the OFA has asked to wait, but I think that 31 years is long enough to wait, and the faster we can get this process done, which would legislation, negative or positive, it doesn't matter. This would be the way to go to get it done before more of our people die. Thank you.
Thank you. There is this old statement that's very true, that justice delayed is justice denied. And we will try to sort these things out and do justice. We are told that we should be seekers after justice, and that's one of the reasons that I ran for Congress. And I really appreciate this today. This has been, you've all spoken from your hearts. You've all spoken with great feeling, and that's what we should have, a great feeling for our community, a great feeling beyond ourselves to the other people with whom we share that community. And we are social beings, and you have your society, which you want to preserve that society, and I appreciate that and want to work with you on that. And the record will be open for 10 days to allow additional materials to be submitted for the record. And we may also, within those 10 days, submit questions to you for response. And at that, we'll stand adjourned. And thank you very much. God bless you.